Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, the Democratic National Convention underway in Philadelphia, of course. Michael Bloomberg on stage now, the former mayor of New York, a Republican who is speaking at the Democratic Convention. We're waiting for this. Ken Davis joins me now. He's the man behind Chicago Newsroom. You can find it at chicagonewsroom.org, but also all over the place. Ken, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
So Salim Muakil is going to join us as well, a columnist in these times. And tonight's a big night because this is really the country's introduction to Tim Kaine.
Well, secondary.
Yeah. Well, that was a Saturday.
That was a Saturday.
That was a Saturday. That doesn't count, right?
So, but hardcore, we were watching it. But yeah.
What do we expect from Tim Kaine tonight? I mean, what are you looking forward to in his speech?
Well, I mean, I would say they ought to just basically roll the tape back and play that again, because
right.
He's not going to do much better than that. You know, I mean, here's this guy who nobody has a clue who he is, and everybody's kind of already biased to think this guy's going to be a loser. And he, you know, what's the ultimate outcome, right, is to have people think you're going to be a loser and in the end say, well, he's not so much of a loser.
That's I live my life in that. That's how I live my life.
We're right? Broadcasters.
Yeah, right.
Is that right? Yeah. So, I mean, he did some of that. And I felt like he did a real admirable job. And it's going to be hard for him really to top that tonight because he can't really talk policy all that much. And
right.
So I don't know.
The vice presidential speech is traditionally a speech in which you send out the dogs. It's an attack speech to Donald Trump. Do you think that you're going to see that from him tonight? I mean, is that sort of his role? Because on Saturday, it didn't really feel like that's sort of the tone that Tim Kaine is comfortable with.
It's hard to get a read on that. I mean, I think that he'll get comfortable with it. He's not so much now because I think he's so hung up on kind of being this nice guy. He's everybody's uncle. But, you know, they've had plenty of other people handling that. I was listening to Leon Panetta on the way in tonight. He savaged Trump. I mean, but it wasn't the name-calling kind of stuff. It was just sort of like, look, I know a little something about national security.
Right, right.
You know, here's my resume. Here's a copy of my resume if you'd like to see it. And this guy, you know, he's not, well, I think the line was something like, he's not worthy of polishing John McCain's boots, you know, something
that's
like that.
Something like that.
Looking
right?
for
well,
that line. That
the big, I mean, we've already had tonight the speech from Vice President Biden. Mm-hmm. Was he his charming self? We missed it here, but did he do his best impression of an outgoing vice presidential?
Hey, Salim.
Hey,
Salim Muakil joins us.
Yes, yes. How you doing, everyone?
In these times. Good to see you. How
I'm
you doing?
Well. Doing well.
So, I mean, you saw the Biden speech.
Yeah.
What did you think of Biden's speech tonight?
You know, I hate to be dismissive this way, but if you've seen one Joe Biden speech, you've pretty much seen them all. It had all of the requisite enthusiasm and the, hey, how you doing? Oh, yeah, I remember you from 35 years ago, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, he did what he was supposed to do. He's the outgoing vice president. He thanked Obama for picking him and said that he just can't wait for the Hillary Clinton administration. You know, he did his job.
Salim, let's bring you in here.
Blue collar shtick.
Yeah, that's right. I'm just a blue collar guy.
Exactly.
What are you expecting tonight from Tim Kaine?
To exhibit his wide range of governmental experience, you know, it is impressive. You know?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I think also talk a little bit about his days as a missionary in Honduras. I think it was Honduras,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
where he learned to speak Spanish fluently, and some, you know, just kind of focusing on his extracurricular passions, I think, as well as, you know, his military credentials, you know, and his white guy appeal.
Yeah.
He's got that down, right?
You know, he's got that down.
Salim, it's interesting for you to bring this up because it's like, what happened that all of a sudden we're talking about trying to appeal to white guys?
Yeah, isn't that something? You know, Trump has this enormous lead.
Yeah,
you know?
I know. Yeah,
and so people are trying to find a way to get into the white guy's psyche.
Us white guys,
well,
we're so ignored.
Both of you guys, watching the first couple days of the Democratic National Convention, it kind of stumbled out of the gate on the first day with some hiccups here and there with booze and this and that. Where do you think they're at on Wednesday night? Are the Democrats getting their message across? Are they winning hearts and minds or more importantly, votes?
I think so. I do. I really do. I think as a contrast to the dark vision, the dire kind of scenario that was evoked by every Republican, mostly everyone, but especially Trump, I think that this presents a more an optimistic face of America, more inclusive face, and I think that that's very appealing.
You know, it's interesting, Justin, that the I was listening to Panetta just now, and he was interrupted by lefties in the hall who were screaming at him, murderer, killer, whatever it was, drone warfare,
right,
and all that.
Right, he's the CIA guy, right?
And, you know, I got to say that I think to a certain portion of the electorate and the people that Hillary Clinton might really kind of need to appeal to, that's probably a good thing. It's not hurting them. It's not hurting them to say our tent is so large that we have to set up tents inside the tent, you know, and that's one of the tents. They just scream about the war.
Well, I mean, the Republicans will want to call out the divisiveness of the party or the idea that it was rigged and the Bernie Sanders supporters didn't get a fair share. And they continue. Donald Trump continues to tweet out that, you know, they're being disrespected. What do you guys think of the way that Bernie Sanders supporters have been treated at the Democratic National Convention?
Well, I think it's in many ways it's to be expected. Bernie Sanders and Trump both completely surprised all of the pundits. Every expectation was completely shattered, and so a lot of the calculations that went into some political calculations that went into trying to arrange for a smooth convention, a smooth ascension of Hillary Clinton, those assumptions were suddenly not as credible as they once were,
right,
when this anti-establishment spirit was mm-hmm. was revealed in the electorate, both in Trump and in Bernie Sanders. And so I think it caught a lot of people by surprise.
I don't know if you saw Troy LaRavier today. He's been doing this whole Facebook string. And he wrote a...
The former principal from Blaine, right?
I should say, yes. Now the head of the Principals Association of Chicago. He wrote a full-throated defense of the Bernie people today that I thought was really worth reading. There's a good argument that it's too simplistic to just simply say, oh, grow up, you bunch of babies, and get with the program. It's much more complicated.
Well, Democrats, and I have a friend, Andy Cobb, who's at Second City, and he does a lot of stuff in Los Angeles now. He's an activist. He's a big-time Bernie Sanders guy, and he's done a ton of stuff for comedy around this stuff. And he had a very articulate Facebook post today that was shared thousands over about the idea that, well, Democrats, he's learned, because he was a Nader Democrat in 2000. And he was one of the guys that said, I don't like either party. I don't like what I see from Al Gore. I don't like what I see from George W. Bush. I'm going separate. We're going to break the system. And he sort of looked at it saying he learned, as he's now, it's been 16 years since that time. And he's learned as a Democrat to say that wasn't a great choice, because that led to Iraq. That led to a lot of different things that happened in the Bush administration for a Democrat. And that this time around, even though he's not necessarily a Hillary backer, he's going with Hillary Clinton because the alternative is not, it's not an alternative.
And there's time. I mean, this isn't until November. A lot can happen between now and then. And I think to be putting this kind of pressure on people who are really genuinely brokenhearted, these are people who worked really hard and they worked for principle, to just sort of dismiss that and say, okay, come on, it's time to get on the bus. No, it's not time to get on the bus. They've got a process to go through.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we have, and I think Bernie Sanders feels a great deal of responsibility for churning up this activism and then giving it over to the Clinton campaign.
You know, I know we're running short on time, but I do want to get in that. I don't know whether any of the listeners heard this, but Gabby Gifford spoke tonight just a little while ago, about half an hour ago or so, and I watched the video clip of it. It is intensely moving. I was sitting down the street in Starbucks, and I mean, everybody says this, but I mean, literally, I could feel tears rolling down my face. I'm thinking, this is stupid. I'm sitting in Starbucks on Michigan. I don't want to do this. But, you know, but it was very moving.
What was her message?
Well, her message is very difficult, because she is, you know, as we all know, she can barely, well, not barely, but she has very great difficulty speaking. Mm-hmm. And she ended it by saying, it's very difficult for me to speak but there are two words I do want to say, Madam President. Mm. And the place, I mean, talk about grabbing the room. Michelle Obama was watching and saying, whoa, I couldn't pull that off. It was amazing. It was really amazing to watch.
Ken Davis, the Chicago Newsroom, Salim Muakil, in these times, we're getting ready for, we're going to bring you live the speech, Tim Kaine's speech, the vice presidential candidate nominee for the Democrats. That's coming up pretty much here in the next 10 to 15 minutes, so we'll keep you apprised. We'll come right back here. We'll take a break. We'll come right back with more. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Salim Muakil and Ken Davis. Salim, a columnist at In These Times. Ken Davis, the host of Chicago Newsroom on CAN TV here in Chicago. So getting ready for speeches tonight. We're still trying to figure out the schedule. CNN says that the president is next. But the Democratic National Convention schedule that came out had Vice President Kaine or Vice President nominee Kaine, then Obama. So we'll see how that kind of plays out. But we'll bring you both. We'll bring you the speeches and react to them as well. Let's.
I think the president's got to go first because he's got to talk up Tim Kaine, right? He's got to talk up the ticket.
I guess there's some decorum. I mean, it does go to the point that you rarely see, or at least in modern history, a sitting president have a spot to sort of rah-rah the next candidate that's coming up. This is, I mean, I think it's been done, but this is something that we haven't seen in recent memory.
Yeah.
And in recent memory, it was primarily because they were political liabilities rather than assets.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, who wanted a president?
They weren't chomping at the bit for George Dubb to speak at John McCain's behalf. Exactly. And the same before that with Bill Clinton and Al Gore. But
exactly.
So what is Barack Obama, President Obama, what does he say tonight? I mean, is he going to be put into the role to be the attack dog and go after Donald Trump?
I got to say, I think he has been waiting months for this. This is like his favorite moment. He's got so many one-liners. He's been calling up all his gag people. He is going to, I don't want to overplay this, but I think it's going to be one of his best performances ever. It's going to be like...
What happened to the idea of expectations being low?
I think this is going to be kind of like the correspondence dinner. It'll be that kind of
thing. You think he'll be jokey and having fun
with
it?
Well, maybe not. I mean, we are dealing with the candidate from the opposite party calling on the Russians to hack.
Yeah, there is that.
I mean, the goal today for Donald Trump to have a press conference was to draw attention away from the Democratic National Convention. And truly, I mean, this is something that almost in decorum, I mean, it breaks decorum in the way that there has been sort of a little bit of, I don't know if it's traditional sort of respect where one party gets the week and the other one gets the other. And that's kind of been thrown out the window. Donald Trump is almost live tweeting the speeches from the Democrat side. Today he went for that, didn't necessarily go in his direction because the negative response to what he said, it was pretty tremendous. I mean, essentially saying, I hope that the Russians can find 30,000 emails. If you can hack those, we'd love to see them. I mean, it's people are saying on the complete one side that it's treason, on the other side, at least unethical.
I don't know if you'd be willing to make some news now, because I think this will be repeated often, but... you know that today Trump said that he's not going to be releasing his tax returns because they're under audit or something.
Right.
I am calling on the Russians to hack the IRS and get hold of his, and I want his tax return up on WikiLeaks by Friday morning.
Julian Assange should do that, right? But I mean, it is something that, I mean, it's a little bit unprecedented that there'd be so much about the other party during the convention. And the goal was for it to be positive. Obviously, Donald Trump wanted it to be positive, but it's negative.
It is negative, and I'm not sure he wanted it to be positive.
Yeah, I don't think he cares.
Yeah, I really don't.
No.
I mean, as he said, and I guess we're talking about it now,
yeah.
We need to listen to his words. He said that he could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and his supporters would still toe the line. And I think he was absolutely serious about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was right about it as well. His appeal is it transcends logic, of course. It hits something else, some other chord in the American psyche.
I heard Jerry Brown being interviewed tonight over on MSNBC Chris Matthews interviewing him, and it was the first time in a long time I've heard Jerry Brown essentially speechless, because Chris Matthews was saying, look, you know, you've done all this stuff. Explain this to me. Why does he say crazy things and he gets more popular? And Jerry Brown said,
like, I don't know. I think there was, and being in this chair and being able to see people who do support Trump be able to text in and talk, the overwhelming feeling is that Trump has created a campaign in which mainstream media, Democrats, analysts, this everybody involved with this station, if you read here, is anti-Trump, and he's the underdog, and everything that is being reported is either a lie, false, or in the liberal-run media, in a way that almost helps him.
Exactly.
I mean, people are excited to see that he continues, almost like a Teflon, you know, a candidate. He continues to go, and they're like, that's the American way.
His appeal is to people who have felt that they have been disconnected from the American dream, that they, like, the last couple of cars on the train just got uncoupled and they're just sitting there dead. He has a brilliant strategy for bringing those people along, and there are many, many more of them than those of us who live in the bubbles of big cities had anticipated that there were, or at least people who believed that they are.
And they were politically invisible, essentially. Right?
Absolutely.
They hadn't given up. He pulled them right on out.
Right. That's right.
So how do Democrats, as Mike Moore points out, that, Michael Moore says that, Trump's going to win. How do Democrats, I mean, they're smart analysts that work for Hillary Clinton's campaign. Mm-hmm. How do they defend that? How do they deal with it? What's the strategy to go against what you just said about people who feel like they are being brought back in?
I would say that some of it is what we're seeing with this kind of dance that's going on with Bernie Sanders and with Bernie Sanders supporters. It's very interesting to me that as I think we've known for a long time, there's some simpatico between the appeal of Sanders, as Salim was just saying, and the appeal of Trump. It's not exactly completely compatible, but there is some alliance. And if Hillary Clinton can really begin to create the aura of building this bigger tent for all of those folks, it might begin to help in some ways.
The other thing that has going, I mean, we saw the reaction to Michelle Obama's speech about breaking the glass ceiling. She came, Hillary Clinton came on the video yesterday with kids in tow, talking about it's not me, it's her, the daughter or the girl that was next. I mean, is it time for her to embrace the idea that she's making history? And that seems to be the emotional aspect of this campaign.
I think that might be the secret weapon, and it really is quite striking that she hasn't used it earlier, because it is a very potent appeal. I mean, it is extremely historic, and it really dawned on me in a new way as I watched it last night that this is a woman president for the United States of America. That's an extraordinary precedent.
If you think about 8 years ago, when Hillary was not doing so well and obviously lost to Barack Obama, a decision was made at the highest levels that she was going to drop the woman thing and talk about strength. That maybe they were worried that a woman would appear weak, and so they really went with this. Hillary is a hawk. Hillary is strong. Hillary is da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it didn't play as well as maybe they had thought it should. And I think that there's some retooling now. That now that it's come close enough, well, I should say, in the last 2 weeks when it got to the point that it's pretty sure that it's going to happen, I think that the message meisters are now feeling more comfortable with going back to the woman thing. Mm-hmm. And I think you are seeing, certainly among the middle-aged and older women, they're kind of coming back to this thing again about, I'd kind of forgotten how cool this was. You hear that a lot. I'd kind of let it kind of escape me.
Right. Well, I mean, it's been months now that we've known that Hillary Clinton, maybe month or months, that is going to be the nominee, and there really hasn't been that much fervor about the idea of being the first woman president.
Not at all.
With the roll call that happened on Tuesday, you saw a lot of tears. You saw a lot of posts on social media about what this means to women around the country, and it feels like that could be that momentum that's been missing for Hillary Clinton.
I think so. And also, as Ken pointed out, we have Angela Merkel, we have the new president, the new prime minister of the UK, and I think that has given a sense of security, a greater sense of security in the fact that we could have a woman chief executive, and it won't represent any diminution of our power, our projection of power.
Of course, one of the last big questions that hasn't even begun to be answered yet is, what about those millennial women? Not even just millennial women. What about the under 40 women, some of the Gen Xers, who really just, you know, didn't grow up with Hillary Clinton. They don't see her as a source of admiration. They see her as kind of an old-fashioned, you know, machine politician.
Absolutely, yeah.
Will they embrace the idea?
They really got into Bernie Sanders. I mean, that was a big part
That's right.
Yeah, and they're not. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting because I talked about this last night that, you know, this is a generation that, you know, some generations that were as active had Bill Clinton in 1992.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In 2008, you had Barack Obama. There was this time you had a candidate that lost. And that's something new. There wasn't really this activist fervor around John Kerry or even Al Gore. But this was the first time where you had a candidate where there was that same sort of spirit, and they lost, so they don't know what to do.
It's been said before, but if you're a 26-year-old woman and you're working in a professional environment, it's the big tone. You're used to this. You're used to being in control and having some degree of equality. Your boss is probably a woman. Who cares? It's a big deal. So
right.
A woman's a president.
Right.
Who cares?
Ken Davis, Salim Wakil in studio with me tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll get to the news. And then coming up, we're going to have speeches from Vice Presidential nominee Tim Kaine and also the President of the United States, Barack Obama. It's The Download. Stay with us.
Now Tim Kaine has taken to the stage. He's walking out right now at the convention in Philadelphia. Let's listen in.
Thank you, everybody. Hello, Philadelphia. Hello, Democratic family. I want to start off by thanking my beautiful wife, Anne, and my three wonderful children, Nat, Woody, and Anella. They're sitting right up there. You know, my son Nat deployed with his Marine Battalion just 2 days ago. He deployed overseas to protect and defend the very NATO allies that Donald Trump says he now wants to abandon. Semper Fi, Nat. Semper Fi. My parents and my in-laws are here, our siblings and their spouses, our nieces and nephews, and hundreds of friends from Virginia and beyond. I love seeing you front and center. Including my friend of 37 years, Senior Senator Mark Warner, my great Governor Terry McAuliffe, and my great friend and Congressman Bobby Scott. We love you all. Today, for my wife Anne and every strong woman in this country, for Nat, Woody, and Anella, and every young person starting out in life to make their own dreams real, for every man and woman serving our country in the military, at home or abroad, for every working family working hard to get ahead and stay ahead, for my parents and in-laws and every senior citizen who hopes for a dignified retirement with health care and research to end diseases like Alzheimer's, for every American who wants our country to be a beloved community where people aren't demeaned because of who they are, but rather respected for their contributions to this nation, and for all of us who know that the brightest future for our country is the one that we build together. And for my friend Hillary Clinton, I humbly accept my party's nomination to be Vice President of the United States.
Thank you.
Can I be honest with you about something? Can I be honest with you about something? I never expected to be here, but let me tell you how it happened. I was born in Minnesota and grew up in Kansas City. My folks weren't much into politics. My dad ran a union ironworking shop in the stockyards. And my mom was his best salesman. My two brothers and I pitched in to work during summers and weekends. And you know, that's how small family businesses do it. My parents, Al and Kathy, here tonight and going strong, they taught me about hard work and about kindness, and most especially about faith. I went to a Jesuit boys high school, Rockhurst High School. Wow, that's a big line for the Jesuits. Now we had a motto in my school, men for others. And it was there that my faith became something vital, my North Star for orienting my life. And when I left high school, I knew that I wanted to battle for social justice. Like so many of you. That's why I took a year off from law school to volunteer with Jesuit missionaries in Honduras. I taught kids how to be welders and carpenters. Y allá aprendí los valores del pueblo, fe y familia y trabajo. Faith, family, and work. Faith, family, and work. Los mismos valores de la comunidad latina aquí en nuestro país. Somos americanos todos. Somos americanos todos. And let me tell you what really struck me there. I got a firsthand look at a different system, a dictatorship where a few people at the top had all of the power and everybody else got left out. Now that convinced me that we've got to advance opportunity for everybody, no matter where you come from, how much money you have, what you look like, how you worship, or who you love. Back in 1970, in Virginia, a Republican governor named Linwood Holton believed exactly the same thing. He integrated Virginia's public schools so that black and white kids could finally learn together, and then the family enrolled their own kids, including his daughter Anne, in those integrated inner-city schools. Many years later, Anne went off to college, and she brought those lessons from that pivotal time with her. And then one day, in a study group, she met this goofy guy who had been off teaching kids in Honduras. Well, Ann and I have now been married almost 32 years, and I am the luckiest husband in the world. You know, let me tell you something. Ann's parents, Lynn and Jinx, are here today, 90 plus and going strong. 90 plus and going strong. Linwood Holton, he's still a Republican, but he's voting for an awful lot of Democrats these days. An awful lot of Democrats. And here's why. He's voting for Democrats because any party that would nominate Donald Trump for president has moved too far away from his party of Lincoln. And I tell you, if any of you are looking for that party of Lincoln, we've got a home for you right here in the Democratic Party. Linwood's example helped inspire me as a civil rights lawyer. Over 17 years, I took on banks, landlords, real estate firms, local governments, anybody who treated anybody unfairly. I had a six-year case against an insurance company that was discriminating against minority neighborhoods all across the United States in issuing homeowners insurance. Folks, Democratic friends, these are the battles that I have fought my entire life. And that's the story. And that's the story of how I decided to run for office. My city of Richmond was divided and discouraged in the early 1990s. We had an epidemic of gun violence that was overwhelming our low-income neighborhoods. People were pointing fingers and casting blame instead of finding answers. And I couldn't stand it. So I ran for city council. And I won that first race more than 20 years ago by a landslide margin of 94 votes. And I've said ever since, if I'm good at anything in politics, it's because I started at the local level, listening to people, learning about their lives, and trying to get results. I see a mayor here who knows what I'm talking about. Later, I became mayor of Richmond, lieutenant governor, and then the 70th governor of Virginia. Now, I was a hard times governor. I had to steer my state through the deepest recession since the 1930s. But hey, tough times don't last, and tough people do. And can I tell you that Virginians are tough people? We are tough people. And we're smart, too. We achieved national recognition for our work. Best managed state, best state for business, best state for a child to be raised, low unemployment, high median income. We shed tears along the way. We shed tears especially together in the days after that horrible mass shooting at Virginia Tech that killed 32 people, from beautiful 19-year-old students to 70-plus-year-old Romanian-born Holocaust survivors. And we shed tears and held each other up, but afterwards we rolled up our sleeves and we fixed a loophole in the background record check system so that we could make our Commonwealth safer. And we got to do that in the nation. We invested in our people, expanding pre-K and higher ed, because we all know in this room that education is the key to all we want to be. All we want to be. And now I have the honor of representing my Commonwealth in the U.S. Senate. I work on the Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committees to keep us safe at home and strong in the world. I work on the Budget Committee with our great Democratic leader of that committee, a spectacular senator who used to be a mayor of Vermont's Bernie Sanders. Everybody, We all should feel the burn, and we all should not want to get burned by the other guy. On that budget committee under Bernie's leadership, we fight for investments in education, healthcare, research, transportation, and I also serve on the aging committee to make sure that seniors like my folks have a secure retirement and don't get targeted by ripoff artists who will scam them out of their savings or overcharge them for prescription drugs. Can I tell you a funny thing about the Senate? Can I tell you a funny thing about the Senate? That sounds like a yes. I spend a lot of time with Republican senators who, once they have made sure that nobody is listening, will tell you how fantastic a senator that Hillary Clinton was. Now look, this journey that I've told you about has convinced me over and over again that God has created in our country a beautiful and rich tapestry, an incredible cultural diversity that succeeds when we embrace everybody in love and battle back against the dark forces of division. We're all neighbors, and we must love our neighbors as ourselves. Now, Hillary Clinton and I are compañeros de alma, and we share this basic belief. It's simple: do all the good you can and serve one another. Pretty simple. Pretty simple. That's what I'm about. That's what you're about. That's what Bernie Sanders is about. That's what Joe and Jill Biden are about. That's what Barack and Michelle Obama are about. And that's what Hillary Clinton is about. Now, si se puede, si se puede, si se puede. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Hey, last week in Cleveland, we heard a lot about trust. So let's talk about trust. Let's talk about trust. I want to tell you why I trust Hillary Clinton. First, she's consistent. She has battled to put kids and families first since she was a teenager. In good times and bad, in victory and defeat, in and out of office, through hell or high water, fighting for underprivileged kids, working at the Children's Defense Fund, fighting to get health insurance for 8 million low-income children when she was first lady, fighting for the well-being of women and children around the world. Hey, can I offer you a little tip? When you want to know something about the character of somebody in public life, look to see if they have a passion that began long before they were in office and that they have consistently held it throughout their career. Do they have a passion? Did it start before they were in office? Have they held on to it consistently? Folks, Hillary has a passion for kids and families. Donald Trump has a passion too. It's himself. And with Hillary, it's not just words, it's accomplishments. She delivers. As senator, after 9/11, I got my New Yorkers right here and my Virginians right here. She battled congressional Republicans to care for the first responders who went into the towers, who went into the Pentagon and saved the victims of those terrorist attacks. As Secretary of State, she implemented tough sanctions against Iran to pave the way for a diplomatic breakthrough to curtail a nuclear weapons program. And she wasn't afraid to stand up against thugs and dictators. And as a key part of the Obama National Security Team, they decided to go to the ends of the earth to wipe out Osama bin Laden. Hey, do y'all remember Carla, the little girl that we heard from on Monday night, who was worried that her parents would be deported? Carla said she trusts Hillary to keep them together. And do you remember the mothers of the movement last night? They said they trust Hillary to keep other mothers' sons and daughters safe. And on a personal level, as he's serving our nation abroad, I trust Hillary Clinton with our son's life. Now, you know who I don't trust? I wonder. Donald Trump. Trump is a guy who promises a lot, but you might have noticed he's got a way of saying the same two words every time he makes his biggest, hugest promises. Believe me. It's going to be great. Believe me. We're going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it. Believe me. We're going to destroy ISIS so fast. Believe me. There's nothing suspicious in my tax returns. Believe me. By the way, does anybody in this massive auditorium believe that Donald Trump's been paying his fair share of taxes? Does anybody here believe that Trump ought to release his tax returns just like every other presidential candidate in modern history? Of course he should. Hey, Donald, what are you hiding? And yet, Donald still says, believe me, believe me, believe me, believe me. I mean, here's the thing. Most people, when they run for president, they don't just say, believe me. They respect you enough to tell you how they will get things done. I mean, that's what most people who run for president do. In fact, you can go on HillaryClinton.com right now and find out exactly how she'll make the biggest investment in new jobs in a generation, how she'll defend and build on Wall Street reform, how she'll reform our immigration system to create a path to citizenship, how she'll make it possible to graduate from college debt-free. You can see how she'll protect Roe v. Wade, guarantee equal pay for women, and make paid family leave a reality. All All it takes is one click. All it takes is one click, and we can see how she'll do it, how she'll pay for it, and how we'll benefit by it. Not Donald Trump. Not Donald Trump. He never tells you how he's going to do any of the things he says he'll do. He just says, believe me. So here's the question. Here's the question. Do you really believe him? I mean, Donald Trump's whole career says you better not. Small contractors, company just like my dad's, believed him when he said that he'd pay them to build a casino in Atlantic City. They did the work. They hung the drywall. They poured the concrete. But a year after opening, Trump filed for bankruptcy. He walked away with millions, and they got pennies on the dollar. Some of them went out of businesses, all because they believed Donald Trump. Retirees and families in Florida, they believed Donald Trump when he said that he'd build them some condos, thousands of them. They paid their deposits, but the condos, they were never built. He just pocketed their money and walked away. They lost tens of thousands of dollars, all because they believed Donald Trump. Charity after charity believed Donald Trump when he said he would contribute to them. And thousands of Trump University students believed Donald Trump when he said he would help them succeed. They got stiffed. He says, believe me. Well, his creditors, his contractors, his laid off employees, and his ripped off students did just that, and they all got hurt. Folks, you cannot believe one word that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth. Not one word. Not one word. Not one word. And I'll tell you, to me, it just seems like our nation, it is just too great to put it in the hands of a slick-talking, empty-promising, self-promoting, one-man wrecking crew. But don't take it from me. Don't take it from me. Take it from former First Lady Barbara Bush. Barbara Bush said she doesn't know how any woman could vote for him after his offensive comments about women. Any woman. Or John McCain's chief economic advisor during the 08 race, who estimate that Trump's promises would cause America to lose 3.5 million jobs. Or the independent analysts who found that Trump's tax plan, given to the wealthy and the biggest corporations, would rack up $30 trillion in debt. Or how about this? How about this? John Kasich, the Republican governor who had the honor of hosting the Republican convention in Cleveland, but he wouldn't even attend it because he thinks Donald Trump is such a moral disaster. Or take it from the guy who co-wrote Donald Trump's autobiography. Here's what he said about Trump, quote, lying is second nature to him. So do you believe him?
No.
I don't know. How about on this side? Do you guys believe him?
No.
I mean, do you guys believe him?
No.
Is there anyone in this building who believes him?
No.
The next president, The next president will face many challenges. We better elect the candidate who's proven she can be trusted with the job. The candidate who's proven that she is ready for the job. And when I say ready, I use ready for a very specific reason. When I lived in Honduras, I learned something. The best compliment that you could pay to somebody was to say that they were listo, ready. Not inteligente, smart. Not amable, friendly. Not rico, rich. But listo, listo. Because what listo means in Spanish is this. It means prepared. It means battle-tested. It means rock solid, up for anything, never backing down. And friends, Hillary Clinton, she's lista. Hillary Clinton is lista. She is. She is ready. She is ready. She's ready because of her faith. She's ready because of her heart. She's ready because of her experience, and she's ready because she knows that in America we are stronger when we are together. My fellow Democrats, this week we start the next chapter in our great and proud story. Thomas declared all men were equal, and Abigail remembered the women. Woodrow brokered the peace, and Eleanor broke down the barriers. Jack told us what to ask, and Lyndon answered the call. Martin had a dream, and Cesar y Dolores said, si se puede, and Harvey gave his life. Bill built a bridge into the 21st century, and Barack gave us hope. And now Hillary is ready. She's ready to fight. She's ready to win. And she is ready to lead. God bless all of you. On to victory. And thank you, Philadelphia.
There you have it, Vice Presidential nominee Tim Kaine addressing the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Just an interesting speech.
Yeah, indeed. Tim Kaine gets up on stage. He does his thing. In studio with me now, Ken Davis and Salim Muakil. What'd you guys think? What'd you think of the speech?
I could say, you know, it was boilerplate. Let me put it that way. He hit all the right notes. He did some attack dog stuff. He valorized Hillary, and he gave himself some personal dimensions. So he hit all the notes.
It's interesting how much of it is a kind of a replay of his Saturday speech.
Yeah, right.
I mean, a lot of it was recycled.
The resume,
I don't know if that's a good thing
top,
or a bad thing,
yeah.
But it was.
Yeah.
And he seemed to have, you know, from what you can see on TV, he had the crowd. So I'm sure he's probably exactly what Clinton world feels they need. And he's doing a very good job at that. Whether or not it's what they really need is hard to say at this point.
Well, at this point, he's up on stage with his wife. Still, the crowd is cheering on in the arena in Philadelphia. You know, he did exactly what, you know, we thought that a vice presidential speech should do, which is play the attack dog role. Mm-hmm. He went after Donald Trump. He talked to, do we believe him? No. You know, he seemed to really take that part of the speech and really try to hammer the opponents.
Yeah, I think he had to prove that he had those kind of chops. You know, he had the ability to be an attack dog. That's, it seems to be one of the qualifications for Veep these days. And
Joe Biden did pretty well.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So I think he performed as expected.
And I think, as we were talking about earlier, he has this additional problem that he has to introduce himself to the world, to the country. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody knew who he was a week ago. So he's got to be a nice guy, but he's also got to be on board with the Clinton agenda, and he's got to be an attack dog. It's a big plate.
You know, I thought that he did a good job. At first, I felt he was a little casual at the beginning of the speech, but that casualness played well towards the end. I felt like he had a real sort of folksy kind of approach to politics. He wasn't sort of, and we'll tear down this wall. You know, he wasn't that kind of stuff. And he
Joe
also
Biden for the 20 teens.
Yeah, right. You're right. But he also had he was bilingual, and he mm-hmm. took what we talked about beforehand, this idea of the Democrats really wanting to sell this inclusivity, this big right. tent, this big tent that the Democrat Party, and we want everybody.
Right. And he stayed away from the rather controversial aspects of his policy prescriptions, that, you know, his pro TPP
yeah.
kind of thing, and
yeah.
and his general pro business propensity. I think he held that in abeyance because he knows that that's a very that would be a very divisive kind of thing to focus on.
All right. Well, Ken Davis, Salim Wakil in studio. Let's take a quick break. We'll catch up on some business. We'll come back. President Barack Obama is going to speak tonight as well. So that's coming up here as well. We're covering the DNC here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. We just heard from now nominee. I should have been saying earlier, presumptive nominee. He accepted the nomination tonight. The vice presidential candidate, Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia, spoke to the masses at the Philadelphia Arena, at the Wells Fargo Arena. Okay, so we're expecting President Obama in the next 20, 25 minutes. They're going to go late tonight. They decide when the president's going to speak, you're going to go late. Ken Davis, Salim Wakil in studio with me tonight. We're talking about the Democratic National Convention day three.
I feel he's going to go for a while.
He is.
You know? This is like a big deal
Well,
for
someone
him.
Mentioned to today on Ro Khan the concept that this may be his last sort of formal kind of yeah. speech like this because there really aren't options. True. There might that's be what, Rose yeah. Gardens and things like right. that, but this is the last speech of the president. In his tenure. Right. What do we expect from President Obama tonight?
Well, I had said before that I think it's going to be a kind of a combination of a diplomatic, presidential speech and the Washington press corps thing. You know, it's the White House press corps.
He's good, yeah.
I mean, because I think the best gag writers in America have been working all day polishing stuff up. In fact, I'm sure you probably got a call too, Justin.
Yeah, no, point. I did. Yeah. I said, no, I can't help you. I got to do analysis and reaction tonight. Salim, you know, the president's going to get up. He's going to finish day three here. You know, when we think about what Vice President candidate Tim Kaine spoke about, the idea of he kind of invoked that, yes, we can. He brought that back.
Si se puede.
Talk about what, you know, Barack Obama has meant to the Democratic Party for the last 8 years. I mean, obviously he's a lightning rod for criticism on the right, but he's done a lot of stuff that's actually gotten done for the social agenda on the left.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, his rising popularity, derives from the fact that people are beginning to assess him from that perspective, you know, looking at him retroactively, looking at what he had to go through, some of the obstructionism he had to face, and in the face of that, despite that, he maintained a sort of calm demeanor, a kind of officious and reassuring kind of
demeanor. I mean, that's his strength. I mean, he's been able to be calm where anyone else in situations that are anywhere similar would
freak out.
Absolutely.
Obviously, and this was brought up too by ABC News and Ro Khan, the idea that, you know, when Barack Obama took over in 2008, we were in an economic crisis, and the Democrats are trying to push that to show that, you know, there has been recovery, that they've moved this country forward. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, a lot of people feel that they've been left out yeah. or feel that the country's gotten worse. I mean, yeah. what does the president have to say tonight to not only his base, which is really this is what this is, a political convention, but also to the country who's watching?
I think that's got to be one of the biggest disappointments for the Obama message machine is, look, you know, we practically pulled off an FDR here in the last 8 years. You know, I mean, we pulled this country out of the toilet, but people don't give us any credit for it because so many people, yeah, they're better off than they were 8 years ago, but they're not up to where they were, or they don't perceive they were, or Worst of all, I think a lot of people are seeing their sons and daughters struggling. They're still living in the basement, you know, metaphorically or in reality. Student debt is one of the unspoken tragedies of the last 10 years. And most of it happened on Obama's watch.
And to be fair, I mean, Senator Sanders ran on that concept.
Absolutely.
I mean, the idea of giving away free that reason that resonated with a lot of young people is because they're faced with mounting debt and having a harder time sort of stumbling out of the gate in their adulthood because of this debt that they accrued.
It's trivializing this a lot, and I should apologize for saying this before I do, but in my generation, you had McCarthy and McGovern, and these were the Sanders of our day. Their message was Vietnam was a mistake. We've got to get the hell out of Vietnam. Whatever else you said you liked about these people, it was that. I think student debt is the thing that drove more people into the Bernie camp than anything else, because just there are so many people whose families are just completely gridlocked. They have no prospect.
Salim, what can Hillary Clinton, and we're going to see her speech tomorrow night, but what is she going to do to build on the legacy of President Obama? What can she do to fix some of the issues that he wasn't able to?
Well, I think she's going to attempt, you know, to make Congress a lot more compliant, or at least cooperative. There may be some change in the congressional complexion. Maybe more Democrats. There's some hope that Democrats can make some significant progress in both houses of Congress, and I think that. She's going to press these particular issues with a sense of empowerment because of the Bernie Sanders contribution.
I'm sorry. No, I keep interrupting you. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry about that. I think that there is a possibility that there's an incipient new movement that's being born in the last few weeks. Washington Post is out with a story just a few hours ago about this. Is it possible that America is turning the corner on guns? And the Gabby Gifford thing tonight probably is I just was looking, that video has just been shared gobs of times in just the last few hours. Hillary Clinton but she might be able to begin to turn the conversation in a way that Barack Obama never was able to. And of course, we understand the thing is so complicated. There's no one law that anyone can pass that's going to suddenly make people stop getting killed by guns or anything else. But the conversation has been so dominated by the right and so dominated by the gun manufacturers and their friends at the NRA that conversation has essentially been roadblocked for the last 8 years.
Right.
And it is possible that
also manipulated to be abolishing amendments.
Absolutely.
Or taking away rights as opposed to finding a way to deal with what we see in the media and what a lot of people even here in the city of Chicago deal with on a daily basis. So it'll be interesting to see if politics can fix that. We had Jessica Disu, who was on, an activist, right before we talked, and that was really the question, is can politics fix, can a candidate, can Hillary Clinton, can Donald Trump, can they fix some of the ills? Can they fix some of the ills of that might be by poverty or violence and things of that nature?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think that this notion of investment, increased investment in the black community, is something that all of the Democrats seem to be in accord with, and that I think will be a great push in the Hillary Clinton administration. If Trump wins, of course, that won't be a question at all.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, Donald Trump has spoken on Twitter and other places saying that, you know, he feels he's going to do well in the African-American community, or he's going to do well in the Latino community. Do you think that that's possible?
So this is African-Americans.
Yeah, right. Do you think that that's possible for Donald Trump? Or, I mean, is it a foregone conclusion that Hillary Clinton's going to get the majority of that vote?
At this point, one has to issue the usual disclaimer that anybody who makes a statement about what can or can't be done or should be done or will be done with Donald Trump is a fool.
Right,
you
right,
cannot
right.
say You just simply can't.
Confounds all expectations. Yeah.
Right. No one can predict it.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's.
How can someone even have expected that a major candidate would suggest that Russia hack emails of another candidate? That's so extraordinary. You couldn't even imagine that in your wildest.
And the more outraged we all get about it, the stronger he becomes, and the more his Duck Dynasty crowd.
Let me ask the question. It's asked a lot, but are Democrats in danger of taking for granted minority communities who always vote Democrat? Because, you know, many could say the last 8 years haven't been great for minority communities. And Donald Trump is a straight shooter saying, I know the issue. It's jobs. I get you jobs. Mm-hmm.
Well, if there's any candidate who would have done that, it would have been Bernie Sanders. I mean, his platform was absolutely heaven sent for the African American community, but he didn't attract much support, surprisingly.
Donald Trump was speaking today at one of his golf courses or something and said, look at me. I got 1,000 Hispanics working for me at this golf course. They love me. That was his reach out. That was his outreach.
That was his reach.
Yeah,
yeah, that outreach. All right. So we're talking with Ken Davis, who's with Chicago Newsroom, Salimu Akil, who's with In These Times. All right. So, you know, we expect the president to take the podium. Rob, is this the president?
Yeah, Justin, it looks as though President Obama is about to take the stage at the DNC in Philadelphia. They just showed another one of those nicely pre-produced videos talking about all of his accomplishments over his 7.5 years in office. And, in fact, here comes President Obama out onto the stage right now.
All right, let's... There he is. He's coming out.
Has to wave to all sides of the stage. Make sure everybody gets a glimpse.
This will take a minute or two.
He's got to take some pictures with everybody.
No, well, you know, he's there. He is the rock star right now.
Yeah, there he is. We'll take President Barack Obama speaking to the Democrat National Convention in Philadelphia.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody. I love you back. Hello, America. Hello, Democrats. So, 12 years ago tonight, I addressed this convention for the very first time. You met my two little girls, Malia and Sasha, now two amazing young women who just fill me with pride. You fell for my brilliant wife and partner, Michelle. Who has made me a better father and a better man. Who's gone on to inspire our nation as First Lady. And who somehow hasn't aged a day. I know, the same cannot be said for me. My girls remind me all the time, wow, you've changed so much, Daddy. And then they try to clean it up. Not bad, just more mature. And it's true. I was so young that first time in Boston. And look, I'll admit it, maybe I was a little nervous addressing such a big crowd. But I was filled with faith. Faith in America. The generous, big-hearted, hopeful country that made my story, that made all of our stories possible. Now, lots happened over the years. And while this nation has been tested by war, and it's been tested by recession, and all manner of challenges, I stand before you again tonight, after almost two terms as your president, to tell you I am more optimistic about the future of America than ever before. How could I not be? After all that we've achieved together, after the worst recession in 80 years, we fought our way back. We've seen deficits come down, 401ks recover, an auto industry set new records, unemployment reach 8-year lows, and our businesses create 15 million new jobs. After a century of trying, we declared that healthcare in America is not a privilege for a few. It is a right for everybody. After decades of talk, we finally began to wean ourselves off foreign oil. We doubled our production of clean energy. We brought more of our troops home to their families. And we delivered justice to Osama bin Laden. Through diplomacy, we shut down Iran's nuclear weapons program. We opened up a new chapter with the people of Cuba, brought nearly 200 nations together around a climate agreement that could save this planet for our children. We put policies in place to help students with loans, protect consumers from fraud, cut veterans' homelessness almost in half. And through countless acts of quiet courage, America learned that love has no limits, and marriage equality is now a reality across the land. By so many measures, our country is stronger and more prosperous than it was when we started. And through every victory and every setback, I've insisted that change is never easy and never quick, that we wouldn't meet all of our challenges in one term or one presidency or even in one lifetime. So tonight I'm here to tell you that, yes, we've still got more work to do. More work to do for every American still in need of a good job or a raise, paid leave or a decent retirement. For every child who needs a sturdier ladder out of poverty or world-class education. For everyone who has not yet felt the progress of these past 7.5 years. We need to keep making our streets safer and our criminal justice system fair. Our homeland more secure, our world more peaceful and sustainable for the next generation. We're not done perfecting our union or living up to our founding creed that all of us are created equal. All of us are free in the eyes of God. And that work involves a big choice this November.
I think it's fair to say this is not your typical election. It's not just a choice between parties or policies, the usual debates between left and right. This is a more fundamental choice about who we are as a people and whether we stay true to this great American experiment in self-government. Look, we Democrats have always had plenty of differences with the Republican Party. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's precisely this contest of ideas that pushes our country forward. But what we heard in Cleveland last week wasn't particularly Republican. And it sure wasn't conservative. What we heard was a deeply pessimistic vision of a country where we turn against each other and turn away from the rest of the world. There were no serious solutions to pressing problems, just the fanning of resentment and blame and anger and hate. And that is not the America I know. The America I know is full of courage and optimism and ingenuity. The America I know is decent and generous. Sure, we have real anxieties about paying the bills and protecting our kids, caring for a sick parent. We get frustrated with political gridlock and worry about racial divisions. We are shocked and saddened by the madness of Orlando or Nice. There are pockets of America that never recovered from factory closures. Men who took pride in hard work and providing for their families who now feel forgotten. Parents who wonder whether their kids will have the same opportunities that we had. All of that is real. We are challenged to do better, to be better. But as I've traveled this country through all 50 states, as I've rejoiced with you and mourned with you, what I have also seen more than anything is what is right with America. I see people working hard and starting businesses. I see people teaching kids and serving our country. I see engineers inventing stuff, doctors coming up with new cures. I see a younger generation full of energy and new ideas, not constrained by what is, ready to seize what ought to be. And most of all, I see Americans of every party, every background, every faith, who believe that we are stronger together. Black, white, Latino, Asian, Native American, young, old, gay, straight, men, women, folks with disabilities, all pledging allegiance under the same proud flag to this big, bold country that we love. That's what I see. That's the America I know. And there is only one candidate in this race who believes in that future, has devoted her life to that future, a mother and a grandmother who would do anything to help our children thrive. A leader with real plans to break down barriers and blast through glass ceilings and widen the circle of opportunity to every single American, the next president of the United States, Hillary Clinton. Now, 8 years ago, that's right. Let me tell you, 8 years ago, you may remember Hillary and I were rivals for the Democratic nomination. We battled for a year and a half. Let me tell you, it was tough, because Hillary was tough. I was worn out. She was doing everything I was doing, but just like Ginger Rogers, it was backwards in heels. And every time I thought I might have the race won, Hillary just came back stronger. But after it was all over, I asked Hillary to join my team. And she was a little surprised. Some of my staff was surprised. But ultimately, she said yes. Because she knew that what was at stake was bigger than either of us. And for four years, I had a front row seat to her intelligence, her judgment, and her discipline. I came to realize that her unbelievable work ethic wasn't for praise, it wasn't for attention, that she was in this for everyone who needs a champion. I understood that after all these years, she has never forgotten just who she's fighting for. Hillary's still got the tenacity that she had as a young woman, working at the Children's Defense Fund, going door to door to ultimately make sure kids with disabilities could get a quality education. She's still got the heart she showed as our First Lady, working with Congress to help push through a children's health insurance program that to this day protects millions of kids. She's still seared with the memory of every American she met who lost loved ones on 9/11, which is why, as a senator from New York, she fought so hard for funding to help first responders, to help the city rebuild. Why, as Secretary of State, she sat with me in the Situation Room and forcefully argued in favor of the mission that took out bin Laden. You know, nothing truly prepares you for the demands of the Oval Office. You can read about it, you can study it, but until you've sat at that desk, you don't know what it's like to manage a global crisis or send young people to war. But Hillary's been in the room. She's been part of those decisions. She knows what's at stake in the decisions our government makes. What's at stake for the working family, for the senior citizen, for the small business owner, for the soldier, for the veteran. And even in the midst of crisis, she listens to people and she keeps her cool and she treats everybody with respect. And no matter how daunting the odds, no matter how much people try to knock her down, she never, ever quits. That is the Hillary I know. That's the Hillary I've come to admire. And that's why I can say with confidence, there has never been a man or a woman, not me, not Bill, nobody, more qualified than Hillary Clinton to serve as President of the United States of America. I hope you don't mind, Bill, but I was just telling the truth, man. And by the way, in case you're wondering about her judgment, take a look at her choice of running mate. Tim Kaine is as good a man, as humble, and as committed a public servant as anybody that I know. I know his family. I love Ann. I love their kids. He will be a great vice president. He will make Hillary a better president, just like My dear friend and brother Joe Biden has made me a better president. Now, Hillary has real plans to address the concerns she's heard from you on the campaign trail. She's got specific ideas to invest in new jobs, to help workers share in their company's profits, to help put kids in preschool and put students through college without taking on a ton of debt. That's what leaders do. And then there's Donald Trump. Don't boo, vote. Yeah, the Donald is not really a plans guy. He's not really a facts guy either. He calls himself a business guy, which is true, but I have to say I know plenty of businessmen and women who've achieved remarkable success without leaving a trail of lawsuits and unpaid workers and people feeling like they got cheated. Does anyone really believe that a guy who spent his 70 years on this earth showing no regard for working people is suddenly going to be your champion, your voice? Hey, if so, you should vote for him. But if you're someone who's truly concerned about paying your bills, if you're really concerned about pocketbook issues and seeing the economy grow and creating more opportunity for everybody, then the choice isn't even close. If you want someone with a lifelong track record of fighting for higher wages and better benefits and a fairer tax code and a bigger voice for workers and stronger regulations on Wall Street, then you should vote for Hillary Clinton. And if you're rightly concerned about who's going to keep you and your family safe in a dangerous world, well, the choice is even clearer. Hillary Clinton is respected around the world, not just by leaders, but by the people they serve. I have to say this. People outside of the United States do not understand what's going on in this election. They really don't. Because they know Hillary. They've seen her work. She's worked closely with our intelligence teams, our diplomats, our military. She has the judgment and the experience and the temperament to meet the threat from terrorism. It's not new to her. Our troops have pounded ISIL without mercy, taking out their leaders, taking back territory. And I know Hillary won't relent until ISIL is destroyed. She will finish the job. And she will do it without resorting to torture or banning entire religions from entering our country. She is fit and she is ready to be the next commander-in-chief. Meanwhile, Donald Trump calls our military a disaster. Apparently, he doesn't know the men and women who make up the strongest fighting force the world has ever known. He suggests America is weak. He must not hear the billions of men and women and children from the Baltics to Burma who still look to America to be the light of freedom and dignity and human rights. He cozies up to Putin, praises Saddam Hussein, tells our NATO allies that stood by our side after 9/11 that they have to pay up if they want our protection. Well, America's promises do not come with a price tag. We meet our commitments. We bear our burdens. That's one of the reasons why almost every country on earth sees America as stronger and more respected today than they did 8 years ago when I took office. America is already great. America is already strong. And I promise you, our strength, our greatness, does not depend on Donald Trump. In fact, it doesn't depend on any one person. And that, in the end, may be the biggest difference in this election. The meaning of our democracy. Ronald Reagan called America a shining city on a hill. Donald Trump calls it a divided crime scene that only he can fix. It doesn't matter to him that illegal immigration and the crime rate are as low as they've been in decades, because he's not actually offering any real solutions to those issues. He's just offering slogans, and he's offering fear. He's betting that if he scares enough people, he might score just enough votes to win this election. And that's another bet that Donald Trump will lose. And the reason he'll lose it is because he's selling the American people short. We're not a fragile people. We're not a frightful people. Our power doesn't come from some self-declared savior promising that he alone can restore order as long as we do things his way. We don't look to be ruled. Our power comes from those immortal declarations first put to paper right here in Philadelphia all those years ago. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that we, the people, can form a more perfect union. That's who we are. That's our birthright, the capacity to shape our own destiny. That's what drove patriots to choose revolution over tyranny. And our GIs to liberate a continent. It's what gave women the courage to reach for the ballot, and marchers to cross a bridge in Selma, and workers to organize and fight for collective bargaining and better wages. America's never been about what one person says he'll do for us. It's about what can be achieved by us together through the hard and slow and sometimes frustrating but ultimately enduring work of self-government. And that's what Hillary Clinton understands. She knows that this is a big, diverse country. She has seen it. She's traveled. She's talked to folks. And she understands that most issues are rarely black and white. She understands that even when you're 100% right, getting things done requires compromise. That democracy doesn't work if we constantly demonize each other. She knows that for progress to happen, we have to listen to each other and see ourselves in each other. And fight for our principles, but also fight to find common ground, no matter how elusive that may sometimes seem. Hillary knows we can work through racial divides in this country when we realize the worry black parents feel when their son leaves the house isn't so different than what a brave cop's family feels when he puts on the blue and goes to work, that we can honor police and treat every community fairly. We can do that. And she knows that acknowledging problems that have festered for decades isn't making race relations worse. It's creating the possibility for people of goodwill to join and make things better. Hillary knows we can insist on a lawful and orderly immigration system while still seeing striving students and their toiling parents as loving families, not criminals or rapists. Families that came here for the same reason our forebears came, to work and to study and to make a better life, in a place where we can talk and worship and love as we please. She knows their dream is quintessentially American, and the American dream is something no wall will ever contain. These are the things that Hillary knows. It can be frustrating, this business of democracy. Trust me, I know. Hillary knows too. When the other side refuses to compromise, progress can stall. People are hurt by the inaction. Supporters can grow impatient and worry that you're not trying hard enough, that you've maybe sold out. But I promise you, when we keep at it, when we change enough minds, when we deliver enough votes, then progress does happen. And if you doubt that, just ask the 20 million more people who have health care today. Just ask the Marine who proudly serves his country without hiding the husband that he loves. Democracy works, America, but we gotta want it. Not just during an election year, but all the days in between. So if you agree that there's too much inequality in our economy and too much money in our politics, we all need to be as vocal and as organized and as persistent as Bernie Sanders supporters have been during this election. We all need to get out and vote for Democrats up and down the ticket and then hold them accountable until they get the job done. That's right, feel the burn. If you want more justice in the justice system, then we've all got to vote not just for a president, but for mayors and sheriffs and state's attorneys and state legislatures. That's where the criminal law is made. And we've got to work with police and protesters until laws and practices are changed. That's how democracy works. If you want to fight climate change, we've got to engage not only young people on college campuses, we've got to reach out to the coal miner who's worried about taking care of his family, the single mom worried about gas prices. If you want to protect our kids and our cops from gun violence, we've got to get the vast majority of Americans, including gun owners who agree on things like background checks, to be just as vocal and just as determined as the gun lobby that blocks change through every funeral that we hold. That is how change happens. Look, Hillary's got her share of critics. She has been caricatured by the right, and by some on the left. She has been accused of everything you can imagine and some things that you cannot. But she knows that's what happens when you're under a microscope for 40 years. She knows that sometimes during those 40 years, she's made mistakes, just like I have, just like we all do. That's what happens when we try. That's what happens when you're the kind of citizen Teddy Roosevelt once described. Not the timid souls who criticize from the sidelines, but someone who is actually in the arena, who strives valiantly, who errs, but who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement. Hillary Clinton is that woman in the arena. She's been there for us, even if we haven't always noticed. And if you're serious about our democracy, you can't afford to stay home just because she might not align with you on every issue. You've got to get in the arena with her, because democracy isn't a spectator sport. America isn't about, yes, he will. It's about, yes, we can. And we're going to carry Hillary to victory this fall, because that's what the moment demands. Yes, we can. Not yes, she can. Not yes, I can. Yes, we can. You know, there's been a lot of talk in this campaign about what America has lost. People who tell us that our way of life is being undermined by pernicious changes and dark forces beyond our control. They tell voters there's a real America out there that must be restored. This isn't an idea, by the way, that started with Donald Trump. It's been peddled by politicians for a long time, probably from the start of our republic. And it's gotten me thinking about the story I told you 12 years ago tonight, about my Kansas grandparents and the things they taught me when I was growing up. See, my grandparents, they came from the heartland. Their ancestors began settling there about 200 years ago. I don't know if they had their birth certificates, but they were there. And they were Scotch-Irish mostly. Farmers, teachers, ranch hands, pharmacists, oil rig workers. Hardy, small-town folk. Some were Democrats, but a lot of them, maybe even most of them, were Republicans, party of Lincoln. And my grandparents explained that folks in these parts, they didn't like show-offs. They didn't admire braggarts or bullies. They didn't respect mean-spiritedness or folks who were always looking for shortcuts in life. Instead, what they valued were traits like honesty and hard work, kindness, courtesy, humility, responsibility, helping each other out. That's what they believed in. True things. Things that last. The things we try to teach our kids. And what my grandparents understood was that these values weren't limited to Kansas. They weren't limited to small towns. These values could travel to Hawaii. They could travel even to the other side of the world where my mother would end up working to help poor women get a better life, trying to apply those values. My grandparents knew these values weren't reserved for one race. They could be passed down to a half Kenyan grandson or a half Asian granddaughter. In fact, they were the same values Michelle's parents, the descendants of slaves, taught their own kids living in a bungalow on the south side of Chicago. They knew these values were exactly what drew immigrants here. And they believed that the children of those immigrants were just as American as their own. Whether they wore a cowboy hat or a yarmulke, a baseball cap or a hijab, America has changed over the years. But these values that my grandparents taught me, they haven't gone anywhere. They're as strong as ever, still cherished by people of every party, every race, every faith. They live on in each of us. What makes us American, what makes us patriots, is what's in here. That's what matters. And that's why we can take the food and music and holidays and styles of other countries and blend it into something uniquely our own. That's why we can attract strivers and entrepreneurs from around the globe to build new factories and create new industries here. That's why our military can look the way it does. Every shade of humanity forged into common service. That's why anyone who threatens our values, whether fascists or communists or jihadists or homegrown demagogues, will always fail in the end. That is America. That is America. Those bonds of affection, that common creed. We don't fear the future. We shape it. We embrace it as one people, stronger together than we are on our own. That's what Hillary Clinton understands. This fighter, this stateswoman, this mother and grandmother, this public servant, this patriot, that's the America she's fighting for. And that is why I have confidence, as I leave this stage tonight, that the Democratic Party is in good hands. My time in this office, it hasn't fixed everything. As much as we've done, there's still so much I want to do. But for all the tough lessons I've had to learn, for all the places where I've fallen short, I've told Hillary, and I'll tell you what's picked me back up every single time. It's been you, the American people. It's the letter I keep on my wall from a survivor in Ohio who twice almost lost everything to cancer, but urged me to keep fighting for health care reform, even when the battle seemed lost. Do not quit. It's the painting I keep in my private office, a big-eyed green owl with blue wings, made by a 7-year-old girl who was taken from us in Newtown, given to me by her parents so I wouldn't forget. A reminder of all the parents who have turned their grief into action. It's the small business owner in Colorado who cut most of his own salary so so he wouldn't have to lay off any of his workers in the recession. Because he said that wouldn't have been in the spirit of America. It's the conservative in Texas who said he disagreed with me on everything. But he appreciated that, like him, I try to be a good dad. It's the courage of the young soldier from Arizona who nearly died on the battlefield in Afghanistan, but who has learned to speak again and walk again. And earlier this year, stepped through the door of the Oval Office on his own power to salute and shake my hand. It is every American who believes we could change this country for the better. So many of you who'd never been involved in politics, who picked up phones and hit the streets and used the internet in amazing new ways that I didn't really understand but made change happen. You are the best organizers on the planet, and I am so proud of all the change that you made possible. Time and again, you've picked me up. And I hope sometimes I picked you up too. And tonight, I ask you to do for Hillary Clinton what you did for me. I ask you to carry her the same way you carried me. Because you're who I was talking about 12 years ago when I talked about hope. It's been you who fueled my dogged faith in our future, even when the odds were great, even when the road is long. Hope in the face of difficulty. Hope in the face of uncertainty. The audacity of hope. America, you've vindicated that hope these past 8 years. And now I'm ready to pass the baton and do my part as a private citizen. So this year, in this election, I'm asking you to join me to reject cynicism and reject fear and to summon what is best in us to elect Hillary Clinton as the next president of the United States and show the world we still believe in the promise of this great nation. Thank you for this incredible journey. Let's keep it going. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
So there you have it, President Barack Obama at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Justin, a speech as much as it was endorsing Hillary Clinton, kind of a victory lap as well.
Yeah, President Obama looking for another 4 years, it looks like. He definitely brings a very triumphant speech to Philadelphia, one that sounds like he's running for president once again. But, of course, he's endorsing Hillary Clinton, who has been rumored to be in the building. So we'll see if she comes up on stage with President Obama. Ken Davis and Salim Wakil in studio with us for the long haul tonight. What do you think of this speech? I mean, a long speech from the president, really his last speech, probably his last speech in front of a national audience in a space like this. What thoughts?
His last speech of this caliber.
With this kind of vast audience as well. I think, you know, he's concerned with legacy. Hillary has to win in order to maintain his legacy, to sustain it, because if Trump were to win, boom, it's gone.
Yeah, 8 years of nothing, right.
Exactly.
Right.
So he's really...
That's interesting. And right now, the television showing Hillary Clinton coming on stage in Philadelphia to join President Barack Obama in an embrace, a hug on stage. Usually, now, I know that, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but usually isn't this the point where she's supposed to come out and hold hands with the vice presidential candidate? Yeah. I mean, isn't that the idea? Yeah. Not the sitting president? But I guess this is unprecedented in the way that we talked about in modern history. You don't usually see presidents making speeches at
everything
conventions.
About this election, everything is unprecedented.
Absolutely.
And, you know, apropos of nothing, I don't know, just I see people outside watching us. if Barack Obama, if they could change the Constitution tonight and give him an extra shot at it, what do you think would be his, don't you think he'd be reelected by an overwhelming
majority? I mean, you know, that's a great question, because obviously he's inspiring as a speaker. He obviously has energized the party. You saw how, for the first time, I would say, in this convention, you saw Bernie Sanders supporters energized and inspired by the speaker that's on stage. That's not their candidate, but meaning that he had a call out to the Bernie Sanders supporters, and he talked about an olive branch, but not only that, saying, get it together, Democratic Party. Learn from the Bernie Sanders camp.
Yeah, you know, I think the prevalence of Trump in the public square has seasoned people to be a little bit more appreciative of President Obama's presentation.
Yeah,
I think that's what's happening right now.
I really like the fact that he just did that direct appeal to Bernie Sanders people. And at one point, when not necessarily Bernie Sanders people, but other people were booing, that was the great line of the night: "Don't boo, vote."
Mm. It was, yeah. That was there's going to be a lot of memorable night. It's interesting too, because the memes have already come out. Most of the mainstream media had copies of the script. They already made the memes. They're out on the internet as we speak.
What are they?
They're mostly speeches. I mean, actually, a lot of it is anti-Trump. The stuff about, you know, how does this? I'm paraphrasing the line, but someone who hasn't represented people his entire life now thinks he can lead
people.
Yeah,
right.
The working people.
Yeah.
But, you know, this, I mean, a tremendously inspiring speech. How do you follow up? If you're Hillary Clinton, she comes on stage today, she captures some of that energy, but tomorrow is her big night. I mean, it's difficult to follow a sitting president this popular.
I think the way she follows up is to focus on the historic nature of this challenge, the fact that it's the first female. I mean, I think that's becoming increasingly prominent as a selling point, and I think she'll focus on that.
That is such a good point, Celine, because I know we were talking about this a little bit during one of the addresses, but 8 years ago, she really didn't focus on the woman thing. She was very busily pushing her strengths.
Right.
And now somebody has figured out that, you know, this actually is a big deal. Mm. So maybe that's what's happening here, and we'll see if that works. But, you know, I noticed the president doing this evening, and I'm thinking, this is a difficult needle to thread. They have to walk this line between being supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement and being supportive of the police. It's a very difficult thing to do, because the Republicans, if you watch Fox News, that they're just making hay with this.
Well, I mean, Donald Trump tweeted tonight. He was live tweeting during the Democratic National Convention.
Right.
Okay, right. I guess that's what you do. Like you said, all bets off with
right.
this
convention. Right.
But he was talking about our country does not feel great already. To the millions of wonderful people living in poverty, violence, and despair. And he also had one, and I lost it here, but it was about essentially saying that we need to protect our law enforcement. I'm right. The law and order candidate.
Well, I mean, the reference that Barack Obama made tonight, which I think, you know, really only Barack Obama can do this skillfully, the thing about, you know, the Black family having that moment when the son walks out the door and they're telling him, be careful out there, is really the same as the family of the police officer is walking out the door and they don't know if they're going to see him back again tonight. And trying to somehow or other make that equivalent or parallel, but much of the country doesn't want to make that a parallel.
No.
So it's a very difficult thing.
Ken Davis, right. Salim Muwakkil in studio. Salim Muwakkil, columnist at In These Times. Ken Davis, the host of Chicago Newsroom. Let's take a quick break. We've got to catch up on some stuff. We come back. Ro Khan is going to join us from Philadelphia. He's in the arena. He was there for the speech. He'll give us an update from the Democratic National Convention here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Wrapping up day three of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, the Wells Fargo Center. Jump in after President Barack Obama delivers the final speech of the night. And Hillary Clinton gets up on stage with him. A big night tonight. that included speeches from Vice President Joe Biden and a candidate for Vice President Tim Kaine. Ken Davis, Salim Muwakkil in studio with us. They've been together all night. Joining us now from Philadelphia, this is a treat, Ro Khan and Anna DeVellantes, both on the line from the Wells Fargo Center. Guys, how are you? The great speech, how did it go?
Just slightly tired. Justin,
yes, a long night.
That speech went on a long time, but it was the best speech I've ever seen Barack Obama give, and I was just finishing up network coverage here, and our Republican analyst said it may be the best speech in modern American political history.
Wow. See, I mean, he was able to rile up the crowd there. Both the Democrats that are for Hillary Clinton and the delegates, of course, for Bernie Sanders. That's what we were just commenting on, that he's the only speaker so far at the Democratic National Convention that's really brought both together.
Well, it's true, Justin. We noticed that every seat here was taken, and not only were people on their, you know, cheering and on their feet, but people were moved, I mean, visibly moved. There was emotion. There were tears. It was exhausting in some ways. It was such a powerful speech, though, and you're right. Ro and I have both commented. We've seen Barack Obama when he was in Chicago speaking in much smaller rooms and still a great speaker, but wow, this nothing he did before has compared. It just wowed everybody.
For you guys to be in the room to see the night unfold, talk about it, because it started early with Vice President Joe Biden. Then we had the vice presidential candidate, Tim Kaine, followed up with the president. I mean, what do you feel like for day three? What would be the grade that you would give the Democrats on DNC day three?
Well, I think that is, well, you know, your high B's there, B plus. There were still a few clunky moments. And there was a strange moment, too, when Leon Panetta was speaking.
Right.
He was getting booed by the California people, and they were waving signs. You know, there is still some discontent in the room. But having said that, you saw Joe Biden, who's, you know, sneaky. Right, he's like sneaky good. He's a guy who's like a wacky Uncle Joe, but then he gave the speech. I think one of the great speeches he's ever given as well. Tim Kaine, again, sort of a sneaky guy too, sort of a little folksy, a little dorky, and he's in trying to sneak in with you there. But you know, you're seeing between Bill Clinton, Michelle Obama, Joe Biden, and now Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton has her work cut out for tomorrow.
Good luck, Hillary. Yeah.
You also have to be happy that Tim Kaine's got to be happy he didn't go after Obama.
Yeah, right.
Because that placement wouldn't have worked.
Yeah,
wouldn't have worked.
Obviously, a tremendous night for Democrats to have the president speak at the convention. That's something that hasn't happened recently in modern history. But talk about, you know, do you feel like the energy, do you feel like they did a good enough job with their speeches to derail the energy that Donald Trump kind of built up after the Republican National Convention? And more so, were they on point with the message that they were sending, hammering and attacking Donald Trump?
Well, the one thing I noticed just being here for the first time is that there was unity here. You didn't hear the boos and the dissension. There's a little bit from the California contingency, the no TPP. There were some shouts and chants. I don't know if that read on air when you saw it on television.
We could hear it, yeah.
You could hear it. Here it was visible, but it was minor, and it was only a part. But it felt very unified. But you also have to remember, you know, these were established politicians who were on the stage today. These are the establishment that some of this party has sort of not necessarily thought was the future. But, boy, did they. They knocked it out of the park. Yeah. The park, in terms of building the case for Hillary, taking the shots, you know, strategic shots against Trump. It was very powerful to witness.
This is Ken. I really can't resist asking you guys about yesterday, about Bill Clinton. Was Bill Clinton a missed opportunity, or did he also hit it out of the ballpark?
Well, you know, it was a very, very personal speech, right? Although it was so personal and so intimate, but lacking a major component too. I think last night, his missed opportunity last night was to sort of in a very subtle way heal that schism that occurred in the late 1990s, 1998, 1999, and formally apologize. Mm-hmm. I think to his wife. I mean, that would have been a very, very powerful moment, I think, and far enough away now in the political reality that it would have no negative political ramification. It would be just seen as a communion of some sort. So I think that might have been a missed opportunity, and also let the nation go on and heal from the, you know, because there's still an awkwardness to all of that.
just like 10 words. And, you know, I know what you're all thinking. I really screwed up. But, you know, she stood by me, too. And then the place jumps.
Something like that, sure. Yeah,
speech right here. All right, so what do we expect from tomorrow? I mean, the big day, this is the final day of the convention. For you guys, I mean, obviously Hillary Clinton being in the building to deliver that speech, it's going to be a raucous day, isn't it?
Well, Hillary Clinton was in the building tonight, too, as you saw. And this is a really, you know, from a standpoint of how the logistics of these kinds of events go, it's fascinating because the Secret Service runs this show, and they had to be able to get her, both of them in, Joe Biden in and then out, right? Then Barack Obama in together with Hillary Clinton. Tim Kaine had to get out. I mean, the way that they have to move these people around so that there's a continuation of this process. Right, in case something happens, and now to get the two of them out and separately, and then try to get these. And as Anna pointed out, there was not a single empty seat in this house. This house had at least 22,000 people in it at some point tonight. So it's a big deal. Now tomorrow, looking ahead, Hillary Clinton. As I said, it's not a small point. She's really going to have to do something here. Generally, as you saw at the Republican show in Cleveland last week, it was a weird moment to end on, right? And I think that she's just got to not do that tomorrow to have this be a somewhat successful convention, because it has been rocky for 2 days. And, you know, look, Barack Obama came and pulled it out of the fire tonight.
There you go. Rokon, Anna DeVellantes, all right, get out of there. I would say go get some sleep and get ready, but, I mean,
that's not going to happen.
You're at the Democratic National Convention on day three.
Come on, Justin. Yeah, right. The after-hours stuff is when the stuff really begins.
Right. Do us proud. I can't wait to hear the stories, right?
Thanks,
Rokon,
Anna
DeVellantes.
What stories?
Appreciate you can hear you guys tomorrow on the show, the big show live from Philadelphia. Thanks, guys.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you. All right. There you go. Rokon Show with Anna DeVellantes tomorrow from 3 to 7 here on WGN, 720 WGN. All right. Final thoughts tonight. A complete victory, if you will, for the Democrats, or do you feel like it was an uneven night? Ken Davis.
Pretty much a complete victory, but they're Democrats, so they'll find a way to snatch defeat from them.
Salim, what do you think?
Well, I was really impressed by the way the speech moved Roe and Anna.
It didn't
really move me that much.
Yeah.
And so it must have been some quality about it that we'll find out more.
Being
about.
In the room.
Right. That's what, and what do you expect tomorrow from Hillary Clinton?
Focusing on the female aspect, you know, the uniqueness of that all.
Yeah, unprecedented, history-making, but it may be a good kind of unprecedented for a change.
Ken Davis, you can check out Chicago Newsroom, chicagonewsroom.org. Find his show on CAN TV. Salim Muakil, a columnist for In These Times. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being my guest tonight and helping us with preview, analysis, and reaction to the speeches at the Democratic National.